two rounds on June 30th and July 7th. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. I'm Parisa Noruzzi, and this is Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. Taking Action comes to you every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, bringing the information and inspiration that you need as you take action in our city to fight displacement, save our schools and communities, stand up for justice, build our power, and hold government officials accountable. Taking Action is produced by the grassroots organization Empower DC, and we welcome your feedback and your show ideas. You can call Empower DC at 202-234-9119. I am very, very pleased today because I get the opportunity to sit down and have a nice long conversation with somebody who I admire greatly and respect greatly. He's been called the champion of the Chesapeake. He's been called the Anacostia River's hero. He is a DC native whose life was impacted and shaped by his natural surroundings and who has now dedicated himself to making and restoring these natural surroundings so that they are healthier and safer for people and for other creatures alike. As I said, I'm very excited today to have Mr. Dennis Chestnut joining us. Thank you so much, Dennis, for being on Taking Action.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me to be on today and talk about something that's near and dear to me. So thank you very much. I'm looking forward to this.
I love these conversations where I get to really talk about your current work, but also sort of talk about your origin story and, you know, how you were influenced by this city that we love. The city that you're a native to. So I wonder, Dennis, especially for those who may not know you very well, if you could share a bit of your background. We know you're a DC native and a lifelong resident of Ward 7. If you could share some of your, you know, early experiences in the city and how they've influenced you as an environmental leader.
Yes, and absolutely. I would say that Washington, D.C. has been a great influence in a lot of different ways that caused me to take the direction in reference to being involved with what I work in and involve myself with the environment. So I've carried a number of titles. Some people have called me an environmentalist and a conservationist and other things. The one which I know we probably will get a chance to talk about later, but I refer to myself as a civic ecology practitioner, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But that civic engagement is something that I feel that I was basically born into, being born in Washington, D.C. in 1949. That was a little while back, but I like to put things in context because in some conversations I have around some of these topics that we discuss, a lot of people, they don't have that frame of reference and they look at everything in the lens of now, I call it. And there's a lot of things, as you said, that are a part of what makes that what it is. And that's also what contributed to my focus on the natural resources and environmental health of the city. So I can start by saying definitely, as you stated, I'm a native Washingtonian and I love Washington, D.C. This is my home. I've traveled, in different places throughout the world. And I've always looked forward, to coming home. Washington, D.C. is a very special place. And so I'm, I'm a son of Washington, D.C., but even as important as that, a son of Ward 7. I presently live right where I grew up. So I'm still in my childhood home, and which puts me right in the neighborhood and the community and the area where I became very familiar with growing up, and it gives me a particular insight. I feel that has really contributed to my focus on these very important assets that we have here in Ward 7, and especially in far northeast Ward 7. But we have a lot of natural resources. I refer to this as the natural resource side of the city. And some people may, think differently about that, because a lot of times when I would be in conversations and referring to far northeast Ward 7 as being one of the greenest parts of Washington, D.C., folks would automatically knee-jerk and say, well, what about Rock Creek Park? Well, I don't pit natural resources one against the other, but Rock Creek Park does not have the Anacostia River. It doesn't have the largest tributary, Watts Branch, that feeds into the Anacostia River. And Ward 7, has even the longest shoreline of the Anacostia River in Washington, D.C. So, the folks will say sometimes, well, what about the Potomac? Well, the Potomac River is not really Washington, D.C.'s river. It has the historical significance associated with the city, but it's on our western edge. It's on that other edge of the city, that southern edge. Anacostia River actually runs into the Potomac. And so the Anacostia is really Washington, D.C.'s river. It runs directly across the city. Of course, all of the other things associated with it. It divides the city on the six of the wards are located on one side. Two of the wards are located on the east side of the river. So, but this is Washington, D.C.'s river, and historically and otherwise. So I would say what really one of the things that contributed to my focus on the environment and the natural resources is growing up right here in that kind of environment. So I'm a product of that natural environment. In my young life, I spent all of my waking hours outdoors. There was very few things to hold us inside of the house when, not one season made a difference. Winter, summer, spring, fall, outdoors. And we got a chance, and I got a chance, rather, to really experience how to function and operate in the outdoors. And it gave me an appreciation for it. And then, another thing that contributed was the time period that I was growing up in. I'm the youngest in my family of five brothers and three sisters. And I got a chance to see some of the things that they were experiencing here in Washington, D.C. as a result of our political structure, which at one time was no political structure. The city was run by commissioners appointed by Congress, and those commissioners were pretty much businessmen who, had their primary interests. But these folks on this east side of the city were not considered, you know, high priority in a lot of the kind of things that, you know, where they are focused. So that made East of the River, far northeast Washington, very unique and different kind of place. And so I would say that contributed to in my family, being the youngest, I was the first one to go to one of the desegregated schools. My brothers and sisters all, you know, attended segregated schools. I mean, I'm not going to say that was all a bad thing totally, but because sometimes what that did was put the best instruction that you could receive in those schools. And so that was a contributor. Growing up through the civil rights era, I was in high school, all right, in the midst. I mean, I was in junior high school here in Washington, D.C., when our president was assassinated, which had a very significant impact on us. And we really understood, and that had something that resonated with the young people, especially as well, I would say, not especially, but as well. And then what really contributed also was, I like to tell folks about this, you know, I was in the scouting program. I was a Cub Scout. I was a Boy Scout. I was an Explorer. And I got a chance to experience scouting at some of the upper levels. And it also gave me a chance to really learn and understand and function in the outdoors and gain an appreciation for it. And then becoming an adult and living in this community, of being a product of this environment, you gain certain things as an adult in your understanding that you reflect on a lot of those other pieces that took place over the process, but it kind of all comes together. And that was when I started having and raising a family. And my children began to gravitate to some of the same places, because I was right here in the same community, some of the same places that, you know, I had experienced. And one of the things I noticed early on, that it was different in the way that it hadn't been treated the same way it was when I was a child. It was more natural environment. It hadn't been as impacted by things like trash and litter and all of those kinds of things. And I started noticing that when my children went to the stream to play, one of the things that we did was I created a little game of a scavenger hunt for them, so that they could pick up some of the trash and debris and things that I knew they were going to be playing around, and I didn't want them to hurt themselves. So we made a game out of it, you know, who could bring back the most items, or who got the oddest item, or all those kinds of things, because I didn't want to keep them from going to these places. I mean, I was at the end of my block is Watts Branch, so they were naturally going to be able to just walk to it and play in it. So, that's one of the things that also started opening my eyes and making me realize that, I had some civic responsibility to contribute in a way. So, I would say that, and then, once you start, you know, I started cleaning up my block, on Saturday mornings and taking my children out, and we would, and they would ask me questions, you know, why are you cleaning the whole block? One of the reasons they were asking, because I was having them with me, and I would get an opportunity to explain to them why that was important, even though we hadn't put down that trash at one end or the other end or what have you. If it stayed there, it would attract more trash. And it also instilled in them the importance of a clean environment, of understanding that it's their responsibility and not somebody else's to make that environment as clean as possible, and especially where they live. So one thing led to the other, and that's how I wound up really beginning, to focus and got involved with some other local actions at that point that, you know, kind of pulled me, you know, I would say like hook, line, and sinker all the way into this work and with the environment.
Thank you so much, Dennis. And I love the context that you created for us. And it really had my mind moving on, you know, of course, we all recognize how the city has changed in so many ways, but you brought up the political realm as well as the, you know, the treatment of natural lands. And of course, one thing that kept circling in my brain is the difference in how kids are raised now, or just life now, that it's far less likely that they would be spending as much time outdoors and in natural environments than you did, and even than I did growing up, right? Because I have a 9-year-old, and the only thing she wants to do is watch YouTube. So, you know, even me playing in a mud puddle or in a, you know, in our little backyard when I was growing up, like, that is, it's not as desired. The culture has shifted, at least in the city. I don't know about in other areas, but you know, as we talk, I'd be interested to hear your observations about, you know, how do we make the type of work that you're doing, and this issue of being good stewards of our environment, you know, attractive to young people again. But I loved this civic ecology phrase that you've coined. I think this is your creation. I've never heard it before. And I love how it intertwines, again, this, you know, understanding of the natural world with the understanding of our civic duties, right, and our role as civic beings. Talk a little bit more about that. And did you coin that term, and sort of talk a little bit more about what that means to you?
Sure, absolutely. Well, no, I really can't take credit for coining the term, but this is one of those things that's a result of being involved in this work. And back it was around 2014, I was privileged to meet a professor from Cornell University that was heading up a department at Cornell University that is, she was a professor of and director of a civic ecology lab in the Department of Natural Resources and Environment Columbia University. And she found me here in D.C. She actually found Groundwork Anacostia River, D.C., which, you know, I'll get a chance to speak a little bit about. And I was heading that, and she was so impressed with the work that we were doing. And she was in the process of pulling together a book. So this civic ecology lab was new. She was bringing it into the university, and I got the privilege of being a part of that first cohort class that she pulled together, and also got a chance to write the opening chapter of the book that she published, which was called The Civic Ecology Adaptation. I'm going to read it. Adaptation and Transformation Transformation, The Ground Up. And it was written in 2015. It's on MIT Press, so folks can find that. And it also featured on the cover of the book our work. We had, the photo was of our group right here in Washington, D.C., working in Watts Branch, cleaning out the Bandalong litter trap. And so that was the essence of how I really began to associate myself with civic ecology. I mean, at first, you know, it hit me like it did everyone else, you know, like I had heard that term ecology, and I understood how that worked. I mean, the interconnectivity and the interrelationship of things, and how everything works together, is not in silos. But I was trying to really, you know, wrap my head around this civic ecology. And I learned a lot from, you know, Dr. Krasny, from her really bringing together such a phenomenal group of people that I got the privilege of being a part of. I mean, there were people in this particular cohort from Iran, from India, from different parts of the United States. It was someone there from Hawaii. I mean, I was learning so much. It was amazing, and it really brought home what this is all about. And so, what civic ecology? That's why I refer to myself as a civic ecology practitioner. I practice it. It's a concept that I came to understand that you have these places that are broken places, and you go about identifying these, looking at these broken places and seeing the value in them, and then doing that civic ecology work that it takes to bring these places, you know, to restore them, to elevate them, to do the things that's necessary to be a good steward of these broken places that you bring back. And the thing that she was so fascinated about, that broken place that we were, she found us at the time that we were right in the midst of restoring Marvin Gaye Park, what was a tremendous story. It's in the book and it's covered. But Marvin Gaye, what's now Marvin Gaye Park, was one of those broken places that the organization I was heading, Groundwork Anacostia River, D.C., we were in the process of doing what I didn't know at the time was civic ecology. And we were practicing civic ecology by doing that work that we were doing to not only bring this natural resource back to into a healthy state, but it also connected. It's not just the ground and the, you know, the stream and the path and all of those things, but it's the people who live, work, and play there. And that's as much a part, and that's what brings in the whole ecology phase of it, but also the civic side of things. Because we can't just clean out our litter trap and happy and pat ourselves on the back that we've removed, you know, hundreds of pounds of trash, kept it from hitting going into the Anacostia River. But elevating the stewardship and connectivity of the community to that work, raising that stewardship level with the community that to a great extent at one point were staying away from that place because they, you know, had different ideas and considerations of it. So that's what civic ecology is, and it could be applied to so many things. I mean, it is that practice is how I approach everything that I do in reference to this work. And so that's why I refer to myself as a civic ecology practitioner.
Mm. I love it. And of course, intersects a lot with environmental justice. And you even said the phrase, you know, where people live, work, and play, which is like a core phrase of used in environmental justice. And you started to talk, you mentioned the trap. So you started to talk a little bit about some of the projects that you've worked on. And I really want to learn more. Tell us a little bit more about the trash trap, but also your other work, other projects that you're proud of, and tell us about Groundwork, with the organization that you founded.
Yes, absolutely. And Groundwork is, you know, and it's a bittersweet because, you know, I was the founder of that organization, led it for 9 years before I moved on. I actually retired from the organization, and the organization brought on a new, the board brought on a new executive director, rather. And that executive director didn't move the organization forward. In 2 years, Groundwork had lost its affiliation. Well, not its affiliation, but its status as a compliant nonprofit, which was really kind of heartbreaking, especially with the work that we were doing and that groundwork was doing, and also the work that had been done. But, you know, again, you know, I went a different pathway, which wasn't really a different pathway. It just I was moving into some different things, and it's never far away from the same work, but just different. So in a lot of ways, the work of Groundwork is still continuing. I mean, you know, talking about Groundwork projects, our first project was a trail connector between a National Park Service Fort Circle Trail, Fort Mahan Trail, right here in far northeast, and the connection of that trail to the Marvin Gaye Park Trail, which, you know, also was very instrumental and a part of leading the effort to actually get Marvin Gaye Park built, renovated, restorated, and becoming Marvin Gaye Park from Watts Branch Park. But also that trail connector was a really big project in so many different ways. I mean, it one of the things I like to tout about that particular trail project was that, you know, the main part of it for me was the buy-in that I was able to of the community to something that to in a community that were very, very skeptical when they saw something getting ready to happen, in which they and not knowing what it was. So by me being involved, I was able to get the community engaged. All of the folks I was working with to do extensive outreach and engagement, and that's what made really the project, you know, the most successful, was that the community bought in and took ownership. Even though it was on federal land, you know, here in Washington, D.C., in parkland. So it was on federal land for the most part. But we were able to, we had 700 volunteers over the course of a weekend that actually started and finished this thing in record time. And we've built on it, you know, since that time by doing things like we've planted somewhere in the range of 200 trees. In that area and some of the areas connected to it. So, you know, that was a big accomplishment. And the thing about it, it didn't cost Washington, D.C., the taxpayers, or the National Park Service, not even one staff hour. And so that was, you know, I mean, I was, you know, that was, When we looked at the finished product and were able to tout that, I mean, you know, we had the superintendent of the National Park Service, the city council member, representative from Ward 7 at the time, Yvette Alexander, all at that ribbon cutting and actually saying, yep, you know, we got this wonderful asset in here and it didn't cost us a penny, not even staff time. So that was our first project. That was in 2009. And successfully completing that, you know, kind of really elevated us and had folks reaching out for us to support and various other things. So we wound up creating a park over in the Parkside neighborhood right now called The Green in Parkside. And it was before any of that. Well, only thing that was existing there were those townhomes that were part of another project that started back in the 90s that started and stopped. And we took a one acre vacant parcel and eliminated some flooding and stormwater management issues, created a park that was a award winning park. It was something that even the community where we put it couldn't believe that a park like that wound up in their community, because even when we were going over the plans, they were saying, people don't put those kind of things over here. So it's a model. We won a sustainability award for that because, you know, 100% of the rainfall that falls on that park stays in that park. And then we directed all stormwater from the adjacent streets onto the park, and we have it was installed an extensive rain garden and cistern system that really benefited that Parkside neighborhood. And some folks who had a regimen of how they prepared for when they heard a big storm was coming, they go and get their vehicles and move them up to another street or higher land. All of that was eliminated from us getting that park installed. So that was another one of the kind of projects that I'm proud of that we were able to move forward. And then, of course, the Bandalong Litter Trap project, which was, and I won't go into all of the details about how it all totally came about, but it was the first project or the first litter trap of its kind in the whole Western Hemisphere. Now, Bandalong litter traps had existed in other parts of the world, even in a place, even in Bangladesh, had Bandalong litter traps. They were developed in Australia, but we had an astute director of the Department of Environment at the time, George Hawkins, who had to do something in reference to a situation that the city was facing, that the Environmental Protection Agency had put the Anacostia River on a trash diet. And that TMDL, they call it total maximum daily load, if we went above it, the city would be fined thousands of dollars per day until they brought it back into compliance. So the litter trap was one of those efforts to show EPA that we were making an effort to address it by reducing the amount of trash going into the Anacostia River. Well, that first litter trap was installed in Watts Branch in Kenilworth Park. And, you know, it's still there to this day. But what it did was it led to now there are five litter traps here in Washington, D.C., in Washington, D.C. proper. There are now litter traps, those Bandalong litter traps in Prince George's County, Montgomery County, and in states throughout the United States. And it all started right here in Watts Branch in Kenilworth Park. And as I said, we managed those litter traps for a decade. And I think now the Earth Conservation Corps is, along with maybe Wardate Woods, are handling the management and maintenance of those. But it was workforce development along with stewardship, because we created, people talk about green jobs. Well, we had a quote-unquote green jobs program. Young adults were the ones who were doing that work, but not only keeping those litter traps managed and cleaned out and reducing all of that trash going into the Anacostia River, but they also were involved in outreach efforts in the community. Being young people, they were able to engage with their peers, which I thought was, you know, very important. And so those are some of the more significant projects that developed on the groundwork. And I will say the groundwork, Anacostia River, D.C., was the D.C. affiliate of a D.C. trust, it was called, of a national network of these organizations called Groundwork Trusts that are located in cities throughout the U.S. And so anyone who is interested can go and look at go to the website and look up Groundwork USA, and it'll take you directly to that whole initiative. And they're doing wonderful work all over the country. And there is an effort right now here in D.C. to revive Groundwork Anacostia. So I'll just, you know, not say much more than that, because there's some people that are making that effort, because they recognize how important groundwork was, how significant our youth programming was, you know, and so, you know, it's being taken forward. So I'm looking to a groundwork 2.0 one day here in DC.
That's great to hear, because you know, as you're talking, you the organization and you as a visionary of that really was filling multiple needs right at the same time. And as I was reading about you to prepare for today, I discovered that you also are a tradesperson and have taught people in multiple construction trades areas. And it made a lot of sense to me that you were able to merge these two areas of carpentry and construction trades and green infrastructure, right? Being able to design things to address stormwater management and all of that. But yeah, speak a little bit to that side of your life and how the two intersect.
Sure. Well, I think about my older brothers and sisters a lot, and especially now that, you know, I'm in the category of a senior, and I think about them because I had opportunities came to me. I came through at a very significant period of time, being born after World War II, right at the time when I was a child when equal accommodations and the civil rights efforts were underway. I was a young adult, when the country was changing in so many ways. I fortunately didn't have to go to Vietnam, even though there was a military draft underway at the time. But fortunately, being a student in college, and it was a motivation for keeping your grades up too, you know, because being a student in college, you knew that if, you know, your grades fell and you carried less than a full load as far as a full schedule, at least 12 hours, you were eligible to be drafted into the military. So not that I had any issues with the military. As a matter of fact, I here in D.C., we had ROTC in every high school at the time that I was in high school. It was military science was a course that you got a credit for. And it was a junior officer corps. And I was in it all 3 years of high school and became a officer, which would have gotten me probably a little, you know, stripe or something if I had gone in. I mean, I would have been, you know, not just like the guys who were just coming straight off the street and didn't know how to drill and those type of things. But the Vietnam War was the reason why, you know, I was not wanting to go into the military. It's not just putting the military is very important, very significant. It does a number of things. I mean, I have three grandsons. Two are still in the military. One is making a career out of it. I don't know what the other one is going to do, but it's so interesting. They're benefiting from it. And I always thank them for their service because it's very important that, we have our military strong and able to defend the country and the Constitution and all of that, you know. So, you know, I constantly, and they, I tell them, thank you for your service. And they look at me like, Abu, they call me, I say, hey, look, it's a personal thing for me. So at any rate, the Vietnam War was what moved me in the opposite direction. And not to dwell on that, but I lost a lot of friends. It was devastating to the country and the community. And especially, it was impactful to family, friends, everything. So, I went the opposite direction, thank goodness, and went to college, but came home, and the employment situation in the late 1960s, early 1970s for Black folks here in Washington, D.C. was kind of limited. And having that college education didn't help it, actually. It just meant that it helped me maybe get a job, but the job was maybe a clerk typist in a typing pool with the government. So you got to remember, we didn't even have a city government at that point in time. So the federal government ran everything. And so, you know, you could, you know, you look forward to civil service exam and those kind of things to get you in the door. And if you had a little something on your, you know, on your resume, that helped out too. But it didn't pay much money. So one thing that happened was the construction unions, which had also been pretty much segregated, had to open those unions up to minorities, women, because the metro construction was beginning here in Washington, D.C. And in order for them to qualify for those federal contracts, they had to abide by the Davis-Bacon Act and open it up, open those unions up. And that another thing is another thing that happened. I was around at the right time. So I went into the carpentry apprenticeship program that was available. I mean, and one of the things that drove me to the carpentry apprenticeship program was that I saw what they were offering as far as a salary. Now, I'll just give you a little comparison. I mean, nowadays these guys are making, you know, they make good money, big money. You know, like the average carpenter can make between, you know, $50 and $75 an hour very easily, depending on where they're working and all. You know, the people that control the traffic with the flags are making $25 an hour. So that's just an example of how the construction industry does pay well. So when I was coming off of that little clerical job, paying $2.62 an hour, and I saw that they were starting apprentices at $8 an hour, and that you would get a increase every 6 months as you continue to advance through your matriculation through the apprenticeship program. My mind immediately went to calculating. Wow, eight, and I saw what kind of money that was at the end of the rainbow, but also where I was starting at. But once I got into it, I really fell in love with building. And I probably was in love with learning, but also building. And I wound up becoming a master carpenter over time, worked in every aspect of carpentry you can name. I mean, fortunately, by talking about this on the air now, if back in the day when I would talk about things like this, I'd be getting phone calls. Hey, do you do basements? Hey, can you hang my door? Hey, look, I got this. And I've never had a problem working. That was one of the things. So it has paid off for me. It allowed me to send all of my, to raise all of my children and family, for them to go to college, get their careers and all of that. But it was construction. But at the same time, the college education paid off because that's what allowed me to, at a point, there was an opportunity that opened up for being able to teach this trade, these skills in the public school system. Because, see, a lot of people don't realize that at one time we had a tremendous vocational education and career education school system here in Washington, D.C., with specific trade schools. You know, I mean, they're trying to move things, you know, in that direction again in some ways. I think it's because they realize that what they threw out when computers came in, now they've realized that that wasn't the way to go, you know. And so actually, that was the reason why I retired from groundwork at the time that I did. Because I was there was an opportunity for me to get involved with a construction education program. It was at a public charter high school here in D.C. And I took the opportunity, even though I was, you know, right close to, I wasn't at full retirement age, but I was close to it. So it gave me an opportunity to do something also that I loved and enjoyed. But one of the things, as you alluded to, that I was able to do as well was to tie in not just teaching the skilled trade of building, teaching those skills to these young people, which I always love working with the young folks. But I was able to bring other aspects. So I was able to bring in green infrastructure, that blue-green infrastructure, and expose them to environmental stewardship and why it was important to control the stormwater and things of that nature. I mean, the idea of public charter school now has a stormwater management project on the back of their campus. They removed asphalt and put in a stormwater management system that is a demonstration model that is excellent. It's a teaching tool as well as something that works. They also have installed solar over that entire building. So, you know, they're generating their own power and other things that were incorporated in as a result of being able to be a part of that kind of program. So, I stayed with that teaching program for several years. And now I'm fully retired. So all those folks that hear about this work in construction, I only do construction of any kind and very little, even at my own home. And my wife is the person that, has a job here or there that I'll do. But, that is really. So, yes, I have been involved in construction. And that's how I got there. And it was very, very good to me.
That's amazing. Yeah. You know, first let me say to the listeners, you're listening to Dennis Chestnut, a DC native who's dedicated his life to many areas of providing support for our community. We just heard about your work in construction trades, but we've been talking about your work in environmental stewardship. And I can't believe it, Dennis, because I could talk to you all day and we only have like 7-8 minutes left. So let's talk about, you're currently the chairman of the Ward 7 Resilience Hub Community Coalition. Tell us what that is. What do we mean by resilience, and what is the work of that that effort right there?
Sure, we can keep this very short and sweet, I would say, but this is one of the most important parts of this conversation today.
Yeah.
Washington D.C. Was built, on marshland. And this part of the city being located where it is, the geography of it, where we have a river, the streams, the hydrology here is very important for this to be maintained, so that we don't run into other kinds of problems. But we know that we are confronted with the climate crisis. Now, I like to use the word crisis rather than change. Because it is here. It's not something that's coming. So this climate crisis that we're facing drives a lot of other things. One of those is extreme weather in certain cases. Being in this on this marshland here in Far Northeast Ward 7, this community is on the front line of flooding. DC has what's called floodplains, and floods that we're in a flood zone, and so there's a 100-year flood, 500-year flood. Well, between 70-80% of the residential properties and the properties in general located within that 100-year floodplain are right here in Far Northeast Ward 7. So a community, we came together to really address some of those kinds of challenges. It's not that we're exclusively focused on flooding, but that became front and center and at the top of the priority list. I mean, we, of course, know that we face these other challenges, heat, food insecurity, all of these kinds of things. And it also ties directly into the environmental justice that we have to confront. I mean, this community, we have landlocked communities between the river and a highway that even adds in the air pollution aspect of things. So it was important for us to come together, and the city was, through the Sustainable DC and Climate Ready DC plans, moving forward, we're trying to get some of those efforts addressed. And the city's limited by what they can do, but the one thing that they do have is they have resources and technical assistance. And we were able to work with the Department of Energy and Environment and move the effort forward to establish an equity advisory group of local residents here in Far Northeast Ward 7 in this community, Dean Wood, Hillbrook, and met for over a year and transitioned into what we with this work, creating some criteria and prioritizing things, and we moved forward with creating what we called a Resilience Hub Community Committee, and ultimately piloting the first Resilience Hub in Washington, D.C., but right here in far Northeast Ward 7 at the Fauntleroy Community Enrichment Center. So that hub is just what it says. It's a hub, but it's not a shelter, so to speak, but it's a place that will be where if you have an issue that develops, call the Resilience Hub, whether it's flooding, whether it's heat related, whether it's food insecurity, whether it's just any kind of what we call disruption that, you don't know how to address. We are working to connect the community and the residents in the city, doing the civic ecology that I was talking about earlier, to get those things addressed through empowering the community and building the capacity of the local community to be in position to be able to adapt where necessary, but to mitigate things where we can, and then to be able to respond, to whatever the disruption is, and then be able to come back stronger than we were prior to whatever it was that was the challenge. So that's basically in a nutshell what the Resilience Hub is all about. And we're working to establish, we have a goal, hopefully we're crossing our fingers, of kicking off an effort this fall to begin the expansion of Resilience Hubs to Ward 6 and Ward 8 and other parts of Ward 7. And so, everybody should stay tuned for that. But right now, one of the things that's most significant is we're conducting workshops for the community here to address flooding and the flood risk. And we've conducted, we've created a three series workshop series that addresses what flooding is so that we can educate the community, what things you can do to address it, your own property, but also in the community. And then we close out that series with informing the community about flood insurance. A lot of people think they have it and they don't, and they don't understand that that property insurance that they have will take care of what happens inside of that property and even on the outside to some extent. But if water comes into their property as a result of a storm or, the river rising or what have you, if they don't have flood insurance, that they're on their own with that. The property insurance won't take care of that. So we're not promoting any insurance, but we do want to inform the community about the FEMA flood insurance program so that they can move accordingly and protect themselves as best they can. So as I said, we started the series in April. We conducted one three-part series. We're two-thirds of the way through the second series. We had two workshops that we've already done over in the Parkside neighborhood at the Cesar Chavez Public Charter High School. And the third workshop will be coming up on June 18th at that same location. And then we're going to follow this up in July and August with some virtual workshops for the folks who now have found out about these and want this information. And so we're going to come with a virtual series this summer as well. So, that's the work that we've been doing. I have some great colleagues and partners, and nothing can be done without partners. We are looking forward to even partnering with Empower DC and getting Empower DC involved in this effort. But we now have, for example, Nature Forward, the Green Scheme, WIN, the Washington Interfaith Network, and others that are part of this effort. So we're really working get this embedded in the community, but most importantly, led by the community. That's the key to the Resilience Hubs.
And I'm so sorry that I have to cut us off there because I feel like we haven't even talked about swimming in the Anacostia. We got a lot more to talk about. So you have to promise me that you'll come back again
I will come back. I will come back. And we do have that swimming event, the Splash, on June the 29th, I believe. So that's going to be right over by Kingman Park in the Anacostia River. So
oh my gosh, I didn't realize
folks can look for that. Yes.
Okay. So, Dennis, is there a good way for people to follow you or stay in touch of the work of the Ward 7 Resilience Hub?
Yes. I would say right now the best way to connect with us is to go to info@w7rahcc.org.
Mm-hmm. So send an email. Yes, to get connected.
Mm-hmm. And our website is getting ready to launch. So our website, of course, is that same, is w7rahcc.org. And all of that information will be available there. But you can also go to the website of the Fauntroy Center.
We'll have to close it.
Thank you so much, Dennis. I'll come back at any time. Thank you for having me today. It's my pleasure.
And thank you for all of your work. I so appreciate you. Thanks to our listeners for listening to Taking Action Today and WPFW. Stay tuned for COVID, Race, and Democracy, but first the news.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Hunter Biden has been found guilty on all three federal felony charges in his gun trial, which concluded that he violated laws that were meant to prevent drug addicts from owning firearms. As a result, the president's son could be fined up to $750,000 at sentencing and face up to 25 years in prison, though it's likely that he'll serve less time because he's a first-time offender. The judge said a sentencing hearing is usually set for 4 months after a verdict, which would put it in mid-October before Election Day. Hunter Biden's conviction marks the first time that a president's immediate family member has been found guilty of a crime during their father's term in office, though Hunter Biden's crimes took place before his father became president. Almost 7 million Americans who are 65 years of age and older are currently living with Alzheimer's disease, which is the fifth leading cause of death for adults over 65. There are no known cures for the disease, but there's currently one Alzheimer's treatment on the U.S. market called Leqembi. Another treatment could receive FDA approval later this year, as it was just recommended to the FDA by a panel of independent advisors. The drug, which is produced by the company Eli Lilly, is called donanemab, and it clears away plaque buildup in the brain of an Alzheimer's patient. In an interview with Dr. Ian Smith, he explained what donanemab can do.
It's showing that there's a 35% slowing of the progression of the disease compared to 27% with Leqembi. The other thing, though, it's also showing an important number, is that if you administer the drug early enough in the disease process, that you can slow it down by 60%. That's a huge number.
Dr. Smith went on to caution that there are side effects to donanemab. Since it is a drug that targets and clears away plaque, it can also cause brain swelling and bleeding in patients, which in some cases can be severe and even fatal. Three patients who took Eli Lilly's drug in late-stage trial did die from severe cases of those side effects. To your local news, if you graduated from high school in New York State, you know about the Regents exams, the series of tests that are required for a high school diploma. These exams have been given in New York State high schools since the year 1878. Well, the state's Education Department, or NYSED, shared its official plan yesterday to make these tests optional rather than a requirement for graduation. The NYSED proposed adopting a, quote, portrait of a graduate, meaning that students must demonstrate that they are critical thinkers, culturally competent, and global citizens, among other proficiencies, in order to graduate. Some are in favor of removing the Regents exams as a requirement for graduation, while others are not. To the D.C. area, the nation's capital is having festivities all month long to celebrate Caribbean American Heritage Month, which has been recognized in June since 2006 by presidential proclamation. It's estimated that approximately 80,000 Caribbean Americans live in the D.C. area. Mayor Muriel Bowser kicked off the festivities with a flag-raising ceremony over the weekend at the Banneker Recreation Center in Northwest D.C. She said that D.C. is a, quote, stronger and more vibrant city and region because of the contributions of its Caribbean community. The mayor also encouraged all residents to join in